So we thought we'd mix up the usual order a little bit today by offering a little Qigong and also having the time in which we offer some reflections come earlier in the day rather than later. Those of you who are used to a particular retreat format, maybe this felt like a curveball. But this time after lunch, after there's food in the belly, warm room, some tiredness, you know, it's often la-la land for a lot of us. So we thought we'd just respect that and try to bring a little bit more energy in at this midday time. So what I wanted to speak about, I'll just offer a few reflections that we can practice with this afternoon, is the love of wisdom. So the theme for the weekend is this merging or coming together, or really inseparability of wisdom and love. So I've been thinking about it as one way that they merge is that there grows and deepens a real love of wisdom. Right? And then maybe tomorrow or later we'll go more into the wisdom of love, right? So Tim offered some reflections about refuge this morning. And really, nothing is possible without some sense of safety. Not perfect safety, but some sense of relative safety. Something trustworthy that we can relax into. Otherwise, it's very difficult to look without, I think it was Steve who mentioned last night, without some sense of fear or ill will or struggling with experience. So starting off with this sense of refuge, particularly refuge in awareness, gives us like some stability, some starting point, some place where we can, you know, let the tripod settle a little bit so we can see more clearly experience. And from this, we start to really be able to look at how this experience, moment to moment, is constructed, is arising, is expressing itself, the sense of myself. How is this coming to be? What's it like? And how is it unwinding or untangling? So with some sense of refuge or stability, we have a vantage point for which we can watch the whole thing unfold according to its own nature. So one time on retreat, I woke up in the middle of the night and I was in a dorm room with a bunch of people, and I woke up and I banged my head on the top of the bunk bed because I wasn't used to being in a bunk bed. So just full whack. And the phrase that came was, you are the process of unfolding. It was just whack. You are the process of unfolding. Right? So take that for what you will. But what we start to get a sense of, sometimes small ways, sometimes hit you over the head ways, is that there's been this, the poet Antonio Machado calls this marvelous error of perception, right? This marvelous error in which we claim kind of the contents of the mind, like what arises in awareness, we claim ownership of that and say that this is who I am. This is me. So as the love of wisdom develops, we can taste a bit of freedom that can start to feel more compelling than our fixations, right? When that tangle starts to untangle a little bit, when life kind of returns, we allow life to express itself, to fade, then energy is freed up. And we start to get a taste for that. It's called the sure heart's release sometimes. And there's a deepening trust in that process, but also deepening love for that process. And you could say like the natural quality of our heart, which is open, bright, radiant, responsive, can shine forward more of the time. We get to trust that, really love that. So this love of wisdom, of course, this means that we need to be able to stay with things long enough to watch their nature unfold and progress and dismantle. So we don't really do this deconstructing process. It's more like we establish ourselves in the proper vantage point, not interfering. And we just, well, look at that. Look at that. But this wisdom that deepens has this quality of kind of deconstructing what seems solid, right? And it does it on its own. We don't have to go at it with a hacksaw, right? It deconstructs on its own. It's already unraveling. We don't have to do that part, but we can watch it unravel. So one of our teachers, when he was in his 20s, spent a lot of time practicing in Asia, the more traditional Burmese form, and was told as a young, very zealous 20-year-old, every time he reported to the teacher, with a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of striving, his teacher told him, just try harder. So everything he noted, everything he was aware of, just try harder. So being zealous and usually coming from any kind of Western culture, we have the striving thing down, right? We know that muscle. And so to be told to just try harder often becomes so tight that something bursts, right? So you can unravel in that way, becoming so tight that you burst. But at that point, he had enough wisdom and wherewithal to realize he was harming himself. And so he went to, and I'm not making any value judgment on whether one style is better, just he went to Thailand, and Thai forest tradition, the instruction was go out in the middle of nature in a hut and be aware, right? Be aware of everything. Be aware of the ground underneath you, be aware of the sky, be aware of how water moves, be aware of heat, be aware of coldness, but learn from nature, right? So this was at Buddhadasa's monastery. Some of you might know it, Suanmok. And I spent a little bit of time there, and the whole thing is designed to the inside and outside, there's not much distinction. There's not a solid barrier between inside and outside. Meditation hall is all out under the trees, right? Open air, open sky, all around. You sleep and are concrete kind of cells, but there are holes in them. So the animals come in. And there's this sense of there isn't so much of a difference between the human and the natural. So one of the teachings of Buddhadasa's that I've appreciated so much and used so much is he was asked, as often these meditation masters were asked, so how then should Westerners practice? Like Westerners with this strong, often striving tendency, but also a strong inclination towards aversion or self-hatred, right? So the striving comes from a feeling like we've got to get over ourselves, got to get rid of ourselves, got to get over this, get past this. So how should Westerners practice with these strong tendencies towards self-beratement, self-hatred? And he said their entire practice should be enveloped with the with the principle and the tone of metta, of loving kindness, of openness, of friendliness. Whole kind of backdrop of their practice should be this. And they should go out into nature, to the trees, the forests, the mountains, until they can feel their belonging with all things, until they can feel their natural place within things. Because there's been this marvelous error in which we've taken ourselves to somehow be apart from nature. Right? So metta as a kind of essential backdrop to our practice, the tone that underlies all of our investigation. But Buddhadasa also pointed to, in a lot of his teachings, the heartwood that I mentioned last night, of the emptiness of self, right? So he said, every true teaching, every wisdom teaching, points one towards the emptiness of a sense of self. So a self that has no inherent, lasting, core existence, right? So again and again, we're circling around that wisdom as well in our practice, noticing that things are arising according to their own nature, according to causes and conditions. Many of us have heard this phrase countless times, but we don't take ourselves to be a part of that whole process, right? We don't observe that we also are a part of that whole process. So in one of my favorite suttas, favorite texts, called the Ball of Honey Sutta. Anyone familiar with that one? Appreciate that one? The Buddha explains, as he does in many places, this kind of law or sequence of conditionality. Like, how is it that something that's inherently fluid and empty becomes trapped and solidified and seemingly solid? How does that happen? And we can experience that in our own way. But he points to this causal link, this conditioned sequence in which that happens. And he explains it in a few different ways. But the essential link, essential links being that through the sensory experience, there's contact. So moment to moment, at our sense doors, we're experiencing contact. So sights meeting the eye, sounds meeting the ear, tactile sensations meeting our sense of touch. And at that moment of contact, there's a feeling, you know, not an emotional feeling, but there's a feeling of it being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. This is one of the classic foundations of mindfulness. There's a feeling tone called Vedana. So contact, feeling, perception. From that feeling, perception arises. So we get a sense of, oh, it's this. We feel maybe some heat and scratchiness on our skin. And, oh, it's my sweater. Right? We hear a noise in the background. Perception recognizes it's the sound of the sound system. It's someone's paper shuffling. It's a train outside, whatever it might be. Perception. And from perception, there can very quickly be thinking and proliferation. This is kind of a simplified version. But all of that is happening in a very moment-to-moment way that we can sense when the mind is steady. So contact, feeling, perception, thought, categories of thought, which then snowballs into my favorite Pali words, Pali being the language that the texts, the Buddha's teachings were written down on, papancha, right? Which is this word that sounds like popcorn to me, popcorn. So this conditioned sequence unfolding according to its own law, but creates this divide in which I'm here perceiving the world, right? Rather than being something that's unfolding kind of on its own, it creates the sense and the mistaken perception that I'm in here experiencing the world out there. Not only am I in here neutrally experiencing the world out there, but I'm usually in some kind of adverse relationship with the world out there, right? I've got to protect myself. I've got to defend this. I've got to get that to be full. So the minute there's this sense of separation, there's struggle arising from this perceptual process. So this feeds on itself. So the sense of proliferation continues to feed on itself. So on the way here, we have driven through this traffic circle on the way into the hall. And the first couple times, we weren't exactly sure where we were going. So we were around and around in the traffic circle. Was that it? No, that wasn't it. And you end up going around in a circle. So this is the way this process works. It spins us around in a circle that starts to seem solid. It starts to seem like a solid, independent thing. The beauty of the Buddha's teachings is that he offers all of these exits, right? Where can we step out of the traffic circle? He said, be careful where you place your attention. You can place it right at the door of the senses, right at the field of sensations before the proliferation happens, before that sense of self becomes really solidified. If you can't catch it there, you'll know it by the pain that you experience from feeling separate, right? So you can also realize when you're spinning, when your thoughts are dragging you, your thoughts are dragging you along. So this papancha is that when one perception triggers a memory, leads to another perception, and then another, and then an opinion, and then a conversation, and then another memory, and then an idea, and it's pop, 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 right? And the brilliant people who are creating our devices, I think, know about papancha. I think they have some idea that this is how the mind works. You sit down at the computer for a simple reason, checking a schedule, finding a phone number, 2 hours later, no. I am researching Spanish immersion in a small Mexican town, you know? So it's one to one to one, link to link to link to link to link, right? And what fuels it all is this sense of separation and wanting. Oh, that looks interesting. Oh, that reminds me of that. I should check that out. I really need to call so-and-so, you know? And soon you've got 25 windows open and you can't remember, I can't remember why I sat down, right? Well, this is papancha. Writ large. But when we're quiet, we're sitting, we can really start to explore those exit points of the traffic circle and to get a feel for what it's like to not proliferate. Maybe not for all time. Of course, we're going to get caught, but we start to get a taste of, oh, there's a choice. No, here I am spinning. There's a choice. Let me come back to sensations, come back to awareness, and let's see how this whole thing feeds itself and moves. Let me watch that. So there's never a point at which we can't practice. There's never a point at which we can't practice. We just get more and more familiar with how this works and appreciative and loving that there is an exit, right? One really brilliant teacher once who taught a whole 2-week retreat that I attended on process of dependent origination, so the 12 links of dependent origination, which is a longer, more detailed version of what I described. And he had flow charts and things written on poster board and graphs and the whole thing just mapped out. And I could tell, being around him, it was almost as though the map, this map was just glowing. Like it was so compelling and it was lighting him up. It was wonderful. And so we were trying to follow along and learn what we could. But I could feel in the room that a lot of us did not share his passion for this map, right? This love of this particular kind of wisdom. And so we could feel in the room minds getting tighter and tighter and tighter as we were describing the different links. And so suddenly he stopped and he said, the sense of self is always experienced as some kind of tension. Right? There's always some kind of tension. So even if you can't catch all of the links in that process, even if it's not completely clear, there's always a place where we can soften resistance. Right? There's always a place to let go. So it's like we can penetrate, deeply understand how it all works, and that can free up the energy. But we can also come closer and closer to how difficult it is to hang on, to continue to cling, to feel separate, how painful that is. And that's the movement of love. Right, comes closer and closer to that experience of separation and can't bear it, honestly. Too painful to stay there. So, so many examples of this, but I last week had my first full eye exam in a while. I don't know if any of you have had recently, but they have all sorts of new technology now where they can take a full three-dimensional picture of your whole eyeball. And I was looking at that with utter amazement. I mean, it's just astonishing to be able to see something that's usually internal, outside yourself, like that is an eyeball, from outside, and then seeing the optic nerve and realizing like that's putting this whole puzzle together, right? Like that highway receiving visual input and creating images that then spark this whole process. It's like, I don't know, there was like the fragility and the amazement of that. Right? That I don't know that this is the kind of design, this is the home we're in, and this is how it works. Like the puzzle isn't, we're putting the whole puzzle together inside. We're creating this meaning. We're creating the world from light, sound, touch, memory. We're putting that together. So somehow just looking at this image of the eyeball from a different view was amazing to me. So we start to get a feeling for that and a real love for discovering that. And that is, again, supported by refuge, but we start to get a taste. Of a little bit of release from that fixation. So at the end of this Honeyball Sutta, Ananda, the Buddha's cousin and attendant, after the person who has kind of struggled to grasp this finally gets it, Ananda makes the comment that in really absorbing this teaching, he says, it's as though somebody who was starving and thirsty and tired is offered a pure taste of something sweet. A little bit of honey, a little bit of sustenance, a little bit of nourishment, a little bit of something sweet. So there's this taste, this flavor of, I don't think sickly sweet, but of nourishment, of goodness, of honey. So sometimes these teachings can feel like a dry mechanical process, like the whiteboards and the charts can feel like can't wrap my brain around that. But we can more and more get a sense of where the exits are and what that taste is, the taste of letting go, the taste of release, and develop a real love for that. Mm-hmm. So it's such a fragile, in some ways, the just the vulnerability of this, so also present, you know, with I don't know, the news cycle, fires, you know, shootings, political situation, can feel so fragile. I work with quite a few elderly people at the end of their lives. I'm currently working with a 94-year-old woman, and so interesting how, you know, different people approach and relate to this fragility, this deepening wisdom of our own mortality, our own kind of diminishment and fading away. And her wealth has allowed her a lot of comfort in the world, a lot of the capacity to kind of rearrange circumstances to be relatively pleasing. But there's also this way in which, when I come to see her, she says, why am I so tired? Why am I so tired? I said, because you're 93, you're 94. But there's a way, I think, especially if we've had some success in insulating ourselves, if our coping strategies have been successful to some degree, shoring ourselves up, there is the sense that I should be able to get out of this in some way, right? I should be able to work this out in some way, to maneuver around this. There's a very, that's kind of how the whole system is designed. We're designed, as Tim was talking about, the survival mechanism, to feel some sense of invincibility so that we can survive. So her growing sense of this is kind of betraying me, this is fragile, this is fading, and it's my fault. I've done something wrong, right? So this is the painful identity kind of wrapped around our humanness, right? Our vulnerable humanness. It's this identity that I should be able to, I had a man with Alzheimer's once, also very wealthy, who whenever he'd experience any sort of discomfort, he would say, the service in this place is terrible. Right? It's just terrible. Like, I should be able to get beyond this, right? So there's the possibility of an exit ramp, right? So in those moments as well, there can be just a deepening bow, right? We too are part of nature. This body is part of nature. This mind is part of nature. It only takes a few moments of the brain being deprived of oxygen to have a very different experience of being in the world, right? So this woman with the tiredness is moving to a place in which she can actually receive more help. But she's now spending almost all of her time and waking energy to decorating her new apartment, right? And this is giving her joy and delight. And so in a sense, it's good, right? But her children are saying, you're 94. You're designing your own apartment. And there's this, again, this hope. Maybe if I can design this just right, I won't have to feel uncomfortable, right? So we just see how we can let go of something in one sense and it just reforms, kind of recoagulates somewhere else. So this is my own papancha, but my son is obsessed right now with the Titanic. And he read about it in a book somewhere, like a fictional book, and then really wanted us to research it so we could find out the real story of what happened, right? And it's hard often to not see the perils of our, not only our collective situation, but also people who, our attempts to fight the aging process as well. So this sense that the Titanic, like my son says over and over again, he's five, it was unsinkable. It was unsinkable. And that was the amount of money that was poured into this vessel and the hubris and the assumption that it was so big and it seemed so impossible that something so big and beautiful could crumble, could crack in half, could sink, right? So this is the marvelous era that we're all in, you know? Just like collectively, individually. And so how do we relate to that? How do we bring kind of that stark wisdom that knows kind of the inevitability of that? Remember what's written on that back thing back there, but something about birth and death on the Han back there, the matter of birth and death. To know that intimately as a process of nature, ourselves is that same process of nature, to not coagulate around our own comfort, success, identity, but also that staying close to that deep tenderness in which we're kind of all on the boat together, right? We're all kind of in this together. So we can, yes, also allows us to really make choices about how much time we spend kind of rearranging the conditions, making a prettier room, and how much time we spend really in love with the process of seeing clearly and waking up, right? So okay, one last Titanic story. I'm not sure why I'm fixating on this right now, but part I didn't know was there was a telegram operator who was getting the distress signals. There's ice in the water. It was the time in which there, of course, weren't any phones, just telegrams coming through. So is getting these distress signals. There's ice in the water, you're in danger, you know, course correct. But he was too busy sending the messages from people on the Titanic to their family and friends saying, I'm having a wonderful time. It's beautiful. This is like a resort. This is the most extraordinary experience I've ever had. He had the stockpile of telegrams that he was sending. And so the ones that said, there's an iceberg ahead, there's trouble, they got shelved. And he was just continuing to do his job, do his assigned role, right? So anyway, it wasn't just him. It was this confluence of conditions. It wasn't about blaming him. But it just struck me in reading about that. That was telegrams, right? And we're doing this all day. I'm doing this all day. So that isn't too stark of an image, but practice really allows us the strength to come really close to the truth of how things actually are, to know what's a true signal of danger and what's our own concoction of an imagined danger, to know that distinction a deeper and deeper way, to know how we create danger, often out of nothing, but also which situations truly are urgent, require our response, and also a deepening love of the wisdom that knows the possibility of release, that knows that taste of honey, however faint. Let's just sit for a minute.